Support for this podcast comes from the Fletcher School of Global Affairs at Tufts University. To start your future as a global changemaker, you must have context across fields like international business, cybersecurity, energy policy, and more. Don't just study global affairs, shape them. Visit fletcher.tufts.edu.
Welcome back to Radio Boston. I'm Deborah Becker. Well, a legal battle continues over the public records of law enforcement officials when they find themselves on the other side of the law. State Attorney General Maura Healey and Boston officials are appealing a court ruling that would have made it easier to get information about people, particularly public law enforcement officials who are accused of crimes. Now, a statement from Healey's office argues that this case is not just about public officials. That statement says that her appeal is to ensure that privacy protections apply equally to everyone. Well, joining us to discuss this complicated case and a few other legal issues is WBUR legal analyst Nancy Gertner. Hi there, Nancy.
Hi.
So let's explain a little bit, and we'll give a little bit of background here. This was a Boston Globe lawsuit, and it was filed after the paper did a series about police officers who were accused of drunk driving. And the Secretary of State essentially said that police can withhold incident reports and mugshots of police officers who are charged with drunk driving. The Secretary of State said the police can withhold those records because of the Criminal Offender Record Information, or CORI, Act. Now, a judge ruled in favor of the Globe and said, no, you have to release those records. And now Attorney General Healey and Boston Police are appealing. So the optics overall aren't good, but let's talk about the ruling and the appeal. In your opinion, does the CORI law apply to mugshots and other records?
The judge's opinion is very straightforward. It says that whatever right there is to disclose public information is governed by the Criminal Offender Record Information Act. And that act states that the protections of the act, the protection to not disclose, only begins after the criminal proceedings are initiated, or when there's a complaint, or when there's an indictment. Booking shots, booking photos, incident reports, those kinds of issues are generated pre-formal complaint, pre-formal indictment. So under the judge's rulings, this has to be disclosed. The structure of the statute is a little – of the regulation is a little interesting, too, whereas the supervisor took the position that you could not disclose police officer booking records. Everyone had the discretion, of course, to disclose the records of ordinary civilians. Hmm. And what the judge is saying is it's really one size fits all here. And nothing can be disclosed after the indictment and the complaint process begins. But before that, everyone stands as equal before the law.
Right. So essentially, this is expanding really the definition of the Criminal Offender Record Information Act and saying, okay, the law says when criminal proceedings are initiated. What does that mean? The state says it means at the time of arrest, and really, you're saying it doesn't. It means at the time of when adjudication begins.
Right, but it's saying two things. When does the proceeding begin? Because that's when the protections of CORI are triggered, which is a very important provision, since the idea is that if people ultimately don't get convicted, you don't want their criminal record to necessarily be widely known. So the one thing was when do those protections begin? And the other thing is, do they apply to everybody equally?
Right.
So during the period when they are not covered, is everybody in the same situation? And the judge said that the statute clearly doesn't make distinctions between police officers on the one hand and ordinary civilians on the others.
Mm-hmm. Now, the Attorney General's appeal in this case also says that in 2010, when there was reform to the CORI Act, provisions were added that would allow this broader definition and more shielding of public records. Is there some sort of ambiguity in that 2010 reform that it makes a point here that perhaps the definition was broadened somewhat and there is a reason for these records not to be public?
It's a matter of interpretation. Clearly, the SJC is going to have to decide this. The judge says the language of the statute requires the position that he's taken. Bear in mind, there are actually all sorts of exceptions to CORI disclosure, but the government didn't claim any. here. There are all sorts of circumstances under which you can keep it from being disclosed, but the government didn't claim that. They simply claimed the right to bar the disclosure of mugshots. Mm-hmm. Of police.
Right.
So there may be another round at some point where they claim in an individual case it shouldn't be disclosed. But right now, the position they took is they have a right to bar all police officers under this ruling of the Secretary of State.
Mm-hmm.
And that's what the SJC is going to have to decide.
Mm-hmm. So, yeah. So do you expect that this will go to the SJC?
I do. Mm-hmm. I do. This
right.
is the kind of issue that the SJC would want to address.
Hmm. Well, speaking of SJC, back at the SJC this week was the second major drug lab scandal to hit Massachusetts. Again, another piece of litigation there. A state SJC judge is expected to formally order prosecutors to produce a list of thousands of cases being dismissed because of the misconduct of a former Amherst drug lab chemist, Sonia Farrick. Now, she pleaded guilty to charges of using drugs that were supposed to be tested as evidence in criminal cases and using samples from the Amherst drug lab. And this week, the single justice of the state Supreme Judicial Court did hold a hearing about this, and this was just yesterday. And after that, we spoke with the legal director for the Massachusetts American Civil Liberties Union, Matt Siegel, and he said that the defendants in these Farrick cases are eager to get their cases dismissed. Let's listen.
We want to get it off the books as soon as possible because people like our clients, Nicole Westcott and Herschel Reeves, they're living every day with the collateral consequences of these convictions. A lot of them are no longer in prison, but they're suffering because the system continues to punish them in terms of housing, job opportunities, et cetera, for having these convictions on their records.
Now, Nancy, we're talking about some 8,000 criminal cases, and this is, you know, just a step in the process here. But why is it being done like this?
Well, first you have to describe that there's a difference between the Ducan cases.
We haven't even mentioned Ducan yet. So you can go ahead. But that was 20,000 cases earlier.
Right. Sorry. But the nature of the accusations in the Farrakh case are different. The Farrakh case was dealing not just with somebody who was messing around with the results of these tests. This is someone who was basically consuming, using the samples. That meant that there was something deeply wrong with that lab that had nothing to do with just whether one aberrant actor could get away with doing this. There were no controls that enabled someone to fundamentally change, take away the samples or fundamentally affect the custody of drugs. There were no controls. So what the defendants are saying here is our cases should be dismissed. Prosecutors should not have the discretion to figure out which cases should remain. The system was rotten here, and the only remedy is dismissal. And Farrakh is exacerbated by the fact that there was a finding of a cover-up.
Right.
The finding that two assistant attorneys general had not disclosed critical information about how long Farrakh, that suggested how long Farrakh had been doing this, which would bear then on how many people were affected. So the scope of the misconduct is broader, which is why the court is saying, let's give this to the whole Supreme Judicial Court. Let's look at it afresh. And it may be that the remedies in the Ducan case, which were dismissal, but the Commonwealth could decide which cases to go forward on still. In Farrakh, everything should be dismissed.
Mm-hmm. Okay. And so is it, do you expect a different outcome here?
I think a different outcome is possible because the scope of the misconduct was different. And as I said, the scope of this misconduct, it was not just that she took drugs in her car and in her work site and used them. It's that she took samples and she took drugs from the custody of the lab. So there's something wrong with this lab that they didn't notice that the amount of drugs was disappearing. In the other cases that we've had, in the Ducan case in Boston, the issue was whether Annie Ducan was falsifying the test results. But in Farrakh, she admitted to doing.
Mm-hmm.
That's right. But in Farrakh, you're really talking about not just bad test results, but when the government when the when police sweep up drugs, you know, and bring them to the to be tested, the amount of drug is critical. If someone is sifting away parts of that, those drugs for personal use and they're not noticing, then there's something fundamentally wrong with the lab as a lab.
Mm-hmm. But we also want to say that in the Farrick case, there's also the involvement of the Office of the State Attorney General. And there were some serious accusations against two former assistant attorneys general. A judge said that the two former assistant AGs committed fraud against the court because they tried to cover up Farrick's misconduct. Now, do you think from this we might see any action against these former assistant AGs?
Well, there are two sorts of actions. I mean, one is what the Supreme Judicial Court is going to do in the face of prosecutorial misconduct. In other words, there had been times when a court would dismiss a case as really a remedy for prosecutorial misconduct. So that's one thing. What's going to happen? What's the relationship between their misconduct and the pending cases? The other thing is what's going to happen to them? I mean, that's an open question. What internally within the AG's office? What issues with respect to bar complaints? That's a separate question.
Mm-hmm. But it would be up to the AG's office in bar complaints, not up to the court.
That's right. This court is not dealing with the disciplinary actions against them. The court is dealing with the relationship between what they did and what should happen to the people in the cases that their conduct affected.
Mm-hmm. I just want to bring up before we go the lawsuit filed against the state by former Governor Bill Weld. And let's explain that suit challenges the way the state delivers electoral votes in presidential elections. The suit says the state should split electoral votes based on the popular vote and instead of the current winner-take-all system. And Secretary of State Bill Galvin is critical. He says that this lawsuit is just trying to make sure that Trump gets elected in 2020. Let's hear what the Secretary of State said.
Simply saying that even states like Massachusetts, where Trump got 34% of the popular vote, he should get 34% of the electoral vote. That's the thrust of the lawsuit.
So, Nancy, what do you think of this lawsuit?
Well, I think it's more complicated than that. So they brought lawsuits like this, not just in Massachusetts, where one man, one vote would mean that the Republicans would split the electoral vote, but they also brought it in Texas, and they brought it in South Carolina. Hmm. The four states are California, Massachusetts, Texas, and South Carolina. And in South Carolina and in Texas, certainly the popular vote tilted to Trump. But in California and in Massachusetts, it was a different ratio. So a one man, one vote, as opposed to a winner-take-all system, would actually have different implications across this country. There's an interesting irony here. Part of the cases on which they rely, the people who are suing, was Bush v. Gore, of all things. Mm-hmm. In which the court said that while the Electoral College is the existence of the Electoral College is constitutionally mandated, states can determine how they elect the electors to that college. But what they can't do is do it in an arbitrary or irrational or unconstitutional manner. And what the plaintiffs in this case are saying is that this winner-take-all system is essentially unconstitutional. And enables interference by foreign powers because you only have to basically affect the elections in a few states.
Right.
So it's certainly a new theory, but it's an interesting one.
Hmm. All right, Nancy Gertner, former Massachusetts federal judge, senior lecturer on law at Harvard Law School, and WBUR's legal analyst. Nancy, thanks for being with us.
Okay, take care.
Stay with us. Coming up, the latest from South Korea as the Winter Olympics wrap up this weekend. I'm Deborah Becker. This is Radio Boston.